Welcome to the London Buddhist Centre's podcast, bringing you the Dharma and guided meditations. If you found value in listening, please consider making a donation. We hope you enjoy this episode.
My name is Surya Gupta, and I'm going to be here for the next few weeks sharing a specific theme called the language of the depth. So yeah, just a welcome from me as well. Hello online too. So let's launch in. So what is the language of the depths? What do we mean by that? So language is of course a kind of key form of communication. And we often think of it in terms of the words we use, but there's all kinds of different forms of languages. So we could talk about body language, you know, how we express ourselves physically, as it were. There's language of the arts, there's all types of different language. So the particular form of language we're talking about is the language of the depths. So, you know, it's how we, language is how we just express ourselves, how we make ourselves understood, how we understand the world that we're in. So what does we mean by depths then? So, well, anything that's not the surface of experience. So we often talk about the depths of the ocean. So we have the great surface, and then we have this depth that people are still exploring and still discovering all kinds of things in the depths of the ocean. So language of the depths is really about communication, human communication, how we make ourselves understood, how we understand the world we're in, but not just the surface level of our experience, but actually what lays beneath. What lays beyond what is known, what lays beyond what is conscious, what even lays beyond what is rational. So it was Carl Jung.
Hi.
Carl Jung sort of popularized the terms conscious and unconscious mind. So he said that so much of us lays beyond the known. So we have our conscious mind, what we already know to be true, what we already understand about ourselves and others, about life itself. And beyond that, we have our subconscious mind that lies just below the surface of that. And then we have the unconscious mind. And he was saying that actually that's really where most of us is. Most of us are in the unconscious mind. So we have our energy, many of our emotions, our knowledge, so much of it is unconscious. And part of the path of growth and development is where we're trying to make the unconscious more conscious. We're trying to make the subconscious come into awareness. So when we talk about developing awareness, like we've been doing with the mindfulness of breathing, we're actually trying to broaden our understanding, deepen our understanding, and allow in more of what is already here, but lays beyond our conscious understanding. So that's the language of the depths. We're exploring a form of communication that helps us get to what is outside of our current awareness, what might be that's within our human experience, but might not yet be fully known by us. And also what's below the surface of our experience. And I would say as well, what is the essential aspects of our experience? Because it's often in the depths that we see what matters most. We see what's most essential. We see what's most significant. Because we're not caught up in the sort of the surface or just the ordinary distractions. So I would say there's three key things that really are part of this language of the depth. So we have the power of stories, the power of symbols, and the power of sound. So over the next 3 weeks, today I'm talking about the power of stories. Next week I'm going to talk about the power of symbols, and I'm going to be sharing a particular symbol that I really I really am drawn to at the moment. And then the final part of this series, I'll be looking at the power of sound. And it's a power of stories, a power of symbols, a power of sound that enables us to go to the depths, enables us to grow. Almost like these powers are things that accelerate growth, I would say. So these three great powers accelerate growth, gives us momentum, because they're enabling us to access the depths quickly, if you like, get to the heart of the matter, get to what's most important, most essential, quickly. So we're able to go with these languages to what matters most. Today is going to be doing the power of stories. I'm going to be sharing a story with you. And talking about, and through that, hopefully, understanding how stories really work. There's so much written about stories and, sort of how important stories are. There's just three things that I'm thinking of this evening around stories. Firstly, we tell stories all the time. Stories are just part of our everyday experience. So you might, have a story already bubbling away about how, like, your day's been, for example. You sit to meditate and you have an experience and you're trying to make sense of that experience. You think, okay, this is how my day has been. So that's already a narrative that you have, that you might have about an ordinary experiences that you've had through a day. So in stories, what we're trying to do often is just make sense of our experience. So we make sense of our everyday experience. We're also making sense of our phase of life that we might be in. When someone was telling me today that they had a significant birthday. So they're looking back and trying to make sense of the phase they've just been in and trying to understand and make sense of and imagine a bit of a story about the phase they're about to go in with this significant birthday. So we might have a story about our day. We might have a story about a phase of our life. We might have an overarching story about our lives overall. So, if you ever find yourself saying, life's hard, isn't it? That's a kind of story in a sense, because within that, you're going to have your examples of why life is hard. You're going to have your feelings about it. You might even have some images there. You'll have a beginning, a middle, and you'll be imagining an end. So we basically have stories about the everyday, about phase, and about, we have overarching stories. If you ever find yourself saying, well, that's just how I am, that's just what I do, that's already a story about your identity, about who you think you are. We don't always stop to ask ourselves, is that true? Because we're getting that kind of sense of us, so we're living our lives through that story, and it just gets often confirmed again and again. So the first thing is, we tell stories all the time. It's part of our everyday experience. We're trying to make sense of our everyday experience. And the second thing is, when we're trying to make sense of our everyday experience in a story, it's almost like we have an experience, we're trying to make sense of it, and then that story becomes a filter in which we then interact with the world. And then, as a result of that, we get more evidence of that story, yeah? So it's a kind of like a feedback loop, the story that we tell ourselves. We have experience, we make sense of it, and then we see the evidence of that same story again and again, and that reinforces the story. So stories are powerful then. The stories we tell ourselves are really powerful because of that. So that's the second point. Stories are powerful, and we create them, and it becomes a filter through our experience, and it begins to then interact with the world that we're in. So the third thing is, and the great thing is that we can then choose what we interpret. We can choose the stories we tell ourselves. So in one of my phases of my life, I used to be a social worker. So one of my jobs was to, in a particular place I worked, my job was to sit with people, often there were teenagers and their families, and help them understand the story of their lives so far, and particularly the difficult experiences they'd had. And I was doing that so that, firstly, they could just express their story to somebody who could really hear, but also to help them make some sense of what happened in their lives. Sometimes we don't understand, like, we've got a story, but we don't understand how it's come into being. So it's like trying to make sense of it for them, help them do that. But crucially, also help them make some meaning of that story that would actually help them live a more helpful life, yeah? help them make sense of it that was positive, beneficial, that would help them heal or even help them make better choices for themselves going forward. So we can we create our stories, but we can choose how we interpret our experiences, and we can change our interpretation of our experience as well. So how you saw, how you were when you were 10 years old, for example, might be different to the story you told yourself when you were 10 years old, yeah? I used to have a story that my school was terrible. Like people used to ask, how's your school? Oh, it was terrible. It's a school of hard knocks I went to. I just sort of say that all the time. And then I sort of look back at a certain point, I think, actually it was kind of hard, but there were some really good things in it that have kind of become part of, like a positive part of, you know, how I see the world. But I didn't see that at the time, yeah? So our stories can change. We can reinterpret our stories and crucially interpret it that actually makes it a point of growth rather than a point of suffering. So that's the three aspects of stories that I've been thinking about. And the story I'm going to share, I'm going to share a story with you tonight. And it's a mythical story. So there's many different types of stories. We have funny stories, tragic stories, and I'm going to share a mythical story with you. What do we mean by a mythical story? So again, there's lots of interpretations of that, but what I mean by it is a story that may or may not be actually factually true. You can't always pinpoint whether it's true or not, but a story that is kind of has archetypal truth in it. A story that reveals to us, you know, our human experience. And so with these archetypal stories, in a way, it doesn't matter what age, you know, gender, race, what time you're living in, because these stories have archetypal truths, they go to the heart of human experience. So no matter what your circumstance or temperament, with a really great mythical archetypal story, you'll see yourself in it in some way, yeah? Because it's pointing to the human heart, the human mind. So it's a mythical story. It's interesting because another phase of my life, I used to be a storyteller. So I'd go into schools and other places and tell stories for a living. It was great, great fun. And I sort of tell quite fantastical tales sometimes, so all kinds of magic would happen. And sometimes the children would say to me, not sometimes, often at the end of it, they'd say, but Surya, they call me Surya. Surya, is that true? And I say, gosh, that's a really good question. Who thinks the story is true? And half the class would, you know, put their hands up. And the other half would be like, well, how can that be true? You know, there's kind of magical birds and there's people on the moon. And how can that obviously be true? But then I would say, and they said, Miss, come tell us, what is it? Is it true or not? And I said, gosh, that's a really great question. You know what? I don't know if it's actually true. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. I can't really say if it's really true. But what I can say is that there is truth in the story. And then we would then start unpacking, well, what is the truth in the story? And no matter how young or old they were able to kind of look at their experience, look at the world around them, think about the adults in their lives, and they would begin with me to unpack what the truth of the story was. In terms of their experience, in terms of being alive, in terms of being a human being. So yes, we got a mythical story this evening. It's an archetypal story, and it comes from the Buddhist tradition. It comes from the Buddhist tradition that's from the Mahayana tradition. So there's three great phases of Buddhism's development. So you've got the first phase, which is the early Buddhism. So you have the life of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, and then you have him becoming enlightened and all the other people that became enlightened around him and all the kind of teachings that he gave and really the way it changed the whole of the society and many countries. So part of early Buddhism was trying to stay as close as possible to the human beings, the Buddha's experience, so that we could sort of really capture it and really honor it, really, and live it. Because he was a real person, a human being, that became enlightened, that became liberated, and enabled so many other people to do so. So there was a real thing that let's stay as close as possible to that. But then about 500 years after that, people said, you know what, the it's great. You know, the early Buddhism is fantastic. And it's very sort of, the image was of this individual man, you know, sitting under a tree, attaining enlightenment, and individuals really doing so. And what this next phase of Buddhism said, it's called the Mahayana, means great way. It said, you know what, really what it did is brought out the compassionate aspect of the Buddha's life. It said, yes, he attained great liberation. He inspired many other people to do so as well. But really, in a way, what really matters, what's the most important thing, is that once he attained liberation, he really taught for the benefit of many. He basically really expressed the great love. In a way, out of liberation came great love and great compassion. And he wanted to help as many people as possible. And so that's really what's most important. And they sort of created this ideal called the Bodhisattva ideal. And in this ideal is basically, yes, you know, attain liberation, attain freedom, strive and do, you know, grow. But remember, you're doing it for the benefit of many. On the back of your own growth, the more you grow, the more you can help others. And so the Bodhisattva is this advanced spiritual practitioner who's attaining liberation for themselves and for the benefit of many beings. Now, that's a great goal. It's a lofty goal. So in order to really inspire people to attain that goal, they basically started using not just the historical Buddha's example, but they started using the language of the depths. They started using stories. They started using symbols. They used color. They used all kinds of, they used images. They used sounds, anything that would really sort of inspire and expand people's imagination to what was possible. So that we'd all be fired up basically and wanting not just to practice for ourselves, but for many, many beings. So this story comes from the Mahayana tradition. And it's from a sutra, a particular sutra called the White Lotus Sutra. And it's called the Myth of the Return Journey. And this is a first story that I heard when I started practicing, that I thought, this is my story. It's a story that seemed to make sense of the life I'd had. And it's a story that I could begin to imagine my future and get a sense of the path that I was going to be treading. And if you'd have asked me at the time to explain that, I wouldn't have been able to explain it. It was just something about the story itself that landed in my conscious mind and somehow resonated with the aspects of me that I didn't yet know. So it really just touched me very deeply and stayed with me. And over time, I feel like I've lived this story in different ways and been different and had every now and again a phase of my life. I'm like, oh, that's the part of the story that you're in now. So I'm going to share it with you. The myth of the return journey. The first thing to say is the return journey. What is that? Well, you know, we go on journeys all the time, don't we? So every time you leave your house, your home, you're going on a journey, you go back home. We don't often remember that or think it's significant because sometimes it isn't, particularly we're just doing what we do every day. It's a sort of everyday, ordinary journey. But we also have journeys that are significant. So gap years, when people go on gap travels, that's a significant journey. Solo travel sometimes, pilgrimages, retreats. Some of you on the winter retreat, that's a journey. Anytime you go on a retreat, it's a journey. And these journeys are significant because whilst it's practical and we're just going on this journey, the fact is, whilst we're on this journey, we want something to happen. We want it to change us in some way. We want it to have an impact. We want to somehow go back home and feel different. So on the winter retreat that I was on, towards the end of the retreat, you know, quite a few people were saying, what's it going to be like going home? How's it going to be? And sometimes there's a bit of anxiety about that. And everyone wants to go home on some level. Like if we said, okay, you're not going home, you know, there'd be probably a riot, you know. So everyone does actually want to go home. But there's this kind of like tension, because on the retreat, something has happened. Something impactful, something significant has occurred. And as a result, you know, you're experiencing yourself differently. In any significant journey, you're experiencing yourself differently. And you're then thinking, how am I going to be when I get home? You want to carry something of that significant experience with you. How's it going to be? Am I going to be able to maintain that? You know, I had this experience a few years ago, and I spent 3 to 4 weeks in the Caribbean visiting my family, and spent quite a lot of time looking, you know, at the sea, looking at the blue sky, in the water, just very spacious and very simple. And, you know, it was fine about coming home, I thought. You know, got to Heathrow, got on the tube, outside my house, all was fine until I went to open the door. And suddenly, I was like, oh no. And I stood for ages outside the door. I was thinking, I don't know if I want to go back in. And it was really shocked me, because I thought, what on earth am I worried about? It just hadn't occurred to me that there was a problem. And I opened the door eventually, and, you know, could see my home, and everything was as I left it. But the thought came was, well, whose life is that? Whose life is that? And why did they make it like that? And it was, oh my gosh, it's your life. And I created it on some level. I created it. So it took me a while. So I thought, I've got to step over this threshold. And I did. And luckily there was a card there from a teacher, a friend, a mentor, on the doorstep. And it was actually a card of a blue sky and sea. And she'd written to it, just saying, you know, wishing me well, wondering how I'm getting on. And I was just like, oh gosh, yes. I was like, I don't want to go back to the life that I had. Because the life that I had was just so packed full of activities, quite overwhelming. I was being pulled in different directions. You know, I wasn't totally clear and exactly was I really doing what I really wanted to do? I wasn't really sure, but I was doing a lot. I was busy. But was it really what I wanted to be doing at that point in my life? I really wasn't sure. So somehow, stepping over this threshold, picking up this card, I thought, I'm going to change. Something has to shift. Something has to change. So sometimes going back home after a significant journey can be a challenge. But it's because we, in that interim, we've grown bigger. We've got a bigger perspective. We've got new ideas. For me at that point, it was this deep sense of spaciousness and simplicity. And all of my being was calling out for more of that. And that's what I confronted when I got back was, oh, that's not the life you were living. So it was like, change it somehow. So that's a kind of return journey. In this story, you know, we are all the characters in this story. And there is a return journey that happens, but we're all the characters. The other thing about a mythical journey, and particularly a mythical journey, mythical story in the Mahayana tradition, is that, yes, all of it speaks to the human experience. It speaks to the ordinary mind, our ordinary conscious mind, you know, our familiar. And it also speaks to our potential. It speaks to the what happens when we realize our potential, when we bring more and more awareness into being. It's like a mirror. We'll see ourselves reflected back in this story again and again. Okay, here we go. Once upon a time, or in a land far away, however you want to start the story, there was a father and son. And they were really close, this father and son. You know, in a way, the son doted on his father. Was inspired by the father, and the father doted on his son. In fact, people saw them together, they were like, "Oh, the son's just going to grow like the father." And the father was this great man. He was this really wise, compassionate being. He contributed a lot to people and the places around him. He just was this good person, the kind of person that you always want to be on your side, as it were, the person who uplifts you when you're down, that gives you wise counsel. That was the father. And all was well. So it was one of those stories that starts, you know, well, everything was good. Now, you know, the father was this kind of businessman and did lots of things in the community. And, you know, part of what he did, they would go traveling. And the son always went traveling with him, and all was good. But one day they find themselves, well, they travel, take one of their journeys, but they find themselves in a very foreign land. And that's normal too, but this place is particularly different. And there's loads of people around. In fact, the father is giving one of his great, you know, speeches. And there's loads of people there. And the son's there enjoying the whole throng, hanging out and talking to people. And for whatever reason, and we'll never know how, we never know why, they get separated. And the son doesn't even realize that he's no longer with his father, actually, because he's just enjoying his company, the company of other people, and doesn't realize he's no longer with his father, and keeps walking and wandering, you know, far and wide with the people he's around. And then as one by one, each individual peels off, goes to their home, takes whatever transport they need to get to, and the son is actually on his own. The father, again, doesn't realize he's not with the son, because they're so close. They're almost the same, you know, they're always together. They always feel like they're together, even if they're not physically there. So the father takes a while to realize the son's not there as well. And then, of course, he's panicked. He sends out all kinds of people to find the son. And day after day, week after week, month after month, how many years elapse, they stay separated. The son realizes at some point he's in this foreign land, and he can't make himself be understood. He can't tell people who he is, because he doesn't speak the same kind of language. So all he's trying to do is just find someone he can connect with, and which proves really difficult. He's trying to find some sense of, well, firstly, safety. He's got need to have food to eat, somewhere to stay, some sense of connection, and it's proving really, really difficult. His life carries on like that, day after day, month after month, year after year. His life ends up being one of survival. He's trying to find a way just to survive. And he has this deep sense of trying to get back to something in that time. But as time goes on, he forgets. He's just trying to live. He's just trying to make a life for himself. Life is hard. Life becomes a struggle. So his father never gives up looking for him. And his heart broke, you know, really breaks. He's grief-stricken, the father. But because he's this wise, compassionate man, he turns his great suffering into great connection. In a way, he really, really understands even more the preciousness of life, the fragility of life. And he just pours that energy, that heartbreak, into helping more people. And as a result, he becomes even more influential than he was before. His whole business expands, his mission expands, he's out there trying to help as many people as possible, but he never forgets looking for his son. So he goes on one of his trips, it's a huge event, he's talking, and so there's all kinds of people at this event. There's people wanting to listen to his great wise words. But on the outskirts, there's all kinds of people selling wares. And there's all kinds of people who hangers on, really, just trying to, you know, make some good of this great occasion. And there's all people as well who are just looking for things to pick up off the floor, people leaving things. And in the corner of his eyes, the father sees someone he deeply recognizes. It's his son. And he's completely overjoyed. And he sends a note to one of his, he's got his entourage as well now, sends a note to a couple of his entourage, go and get that man now. That is my son. Tell him I'm here. So the two guys race after the son, and you know, the son though, I mean, he's by this time disheveled, you know, he's very thin, he sees these two great beings dressed really nicely, healthy looking, fit people running after him, and he just scarpers, you know, thinks they're out to get him, thinks they're going to imprison him, thinks they're going to get him for whatever he's been doing to survive all these years. They catch up with him, but he's so terrified he faints. So a note goes back to the great man and says, look, you know, we got to leave him alone. He's just not, he won't even hear what we had to say. We're trying to tell him that you're his father. He can't even understand us. So basically this father realizes that that's not the way to get him. The father realizes he's in a much better plan, a more gradual plan. So he sends somebody to connect with the son, who's just a little bit more ordinary, just a little bit more like him. They're dressed very humbly, and they're a bit more confident, they're a bit brighter than he is, but he can relate to them. And, you know, he just makes friends with them. And, you know, this person shows them different ways to get food, different ways to they can live. And the son begins to really rely on their friendship, really on and appreciates their friendship. It's the first person that's been really kind to them, who understands their situation. So, and then one day this friend turns up and says, friend turns up and actually looks even brighter, looks even better dressed and says, hey, where you been? And he tells them, actually, I've got this job at this great mansion, one of the biggest mansions in this other country. And in fact, they're looking for people. So the son, of course, says, well, do you think that I could work there? And he says, I reckon you could. But he goes, I don't want to work in a mansion, though. That's like way too much for me. He says, don't worry. There's loads of different jobs. In fact, there's a great piles of dirt. They're wanting people to clear. Do you think you can do that? And the son goes, yeah, that's what kind of stuff I've been doing. Absolutely, I can do that. So the son goes to the great man's mansion and, you know, is really overawed by this mansion, really struck by it, quite terrified by it. But then he's taken to these great piles of dirt, says, just clear that. And he does, day after day, month after month, he's clearing these great piles, and they give him somewhere to stay, like a hut, they give him food, they even give him money. So suddenly he's got more than he had for as long as he could remember. So he's happy. And every now and again, he glances at the great mansion and, you know, just think, God, what's it like? What's it like in there then, you know? And every now and again, the great man comes out and just smiles at him and says hi, and then gradually chats to him occasionally. And the first time he does that, he's terrified, of course, the son is, but gradually he thinks, actually, I think he's okay. He's not going to harm me. And they struck up a bit of a connection. Next thing, all's going well. He gets a message like, hey, can you clean the mansion? There's a basement down in the mansion. So he goes into the mansion for the first time, and he goes into the basement, cleans the basement. And then eventually, as you can imagine, what happens is he does such a great job that he then goes to the different rooms in the mansion. And as he's going to different rooms, he's connecting with the great man more and more. Until one day, the great man, he's very easy around him. What he realizes every time he's with his company, he just feels better about himself. He just feels more able. So one day the great man says, you know what, you've been doing such a brilliant job. You've been loyal, you've been trustworthy, you've been honest, you've been friendly. I've really appreciated you. I would like you to help me directly in my business. And he says to him, I need you to count all the money. Count all the money, be at the heart of things. I trust you. And the son realizes, or the man, the young man realizes, yeah, I can do that. He's kind of awestruck. At the same time, he's like, yes, I'm ready to step into that. So in a way, that's how the story is. And you could say it could end there. The son basically thinks, looks at his life and thinks, I can't believe that I'm here in this palace, you know, remembering how it was for him. And he starts going on trips with the great man. And it's interesting that his change in status, all the kind of great clothes that he wears and everything like that, doesn't make him arrogant, doesn't make him superior, have a sense of superior. In fact, when he goes out on the great tours with the great man, he sees people that were once like him on the outskirts, and his heart opens, and he really, really wants to be able to help them in the way that he was helped. So let's unpack this story a little bit. What is it about? How is it a mirror for you, for me? What's it say about our lives? So the beginning, you've got this two, the father and son, they're united. They are together. The son assumes that he's going to grow up to be like the father, and the father's just guiding him so he grows up well, grows up positive. And in a way, that's kind of how our actual lives might start. Our lives start with a lot of learning. Our lives start with a lot of growth. Not everyone's lives will start in this kind of happy, positive way, of course, but certainly there's a lot of learning. There's a lot of discovery when we're growing up. There's a lot of sense of, you know, what is this life that I'm living? So that's kind of how our lives often start, with a sense of possibility. And that's what teachers often say to children, don't they? What do you want to do when you grow up? And you've got all these, you know, ideas, all these positive things often. So that's how it starts. But actually, along the way, you know, with this sense of possibility, this sense of growth, often along the way, there's a point of separation. There's a point of disconnection. There might be a point of suffering. So for me, I remember a point that happened to me. I was brought up here in East London, but my parents took us back, me and my sister, back to the Caribbean when I was quite young. Whilst they're getting themselves together, they're part of the Windrush generation, and things were quite challenging. So they kind of just thought, let's stay with the grandparents and we'll just kind of make life for ourselves. So I came back. So I was born here, but then went to the Caribbean, then came back again. And when I came back, I was probably about five. And I remember being where we were living at the time. I remember I'd fallen off the climbing frames at school. And I sort of banged my head. And I remember walking back home afterwards and just looking around and going, where am I? And how did I get here? And what am I doing here? And a real shift. So I was looking at the graffiti on the wall. I was looking at the greyness of the sky. I was looking at the kind of misery that seemed to be around me. People just didn't look very happy. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I want this. And I actually then thought, I want beauty. So somewhere, again, I couldn't have explained it, but I just had a sense of there's more, there has to be more than this. And I also thought at the time, don't know how this thought came to mind. I didn't like the name I was given as a child for some reason. And I basically was like, I'm going to change my name when I'm older. Took me a long time to work out how that was going to happen, of course. That was a point of separation. Before that, I probably was not even, I was just living life. I was just in it. And that point came where I looked at my environment and just thought, how did I get here? What did it all mean? How can I create what I really want? And we can have those periods all throughout our lives, of course, where we're standing back and going, what's going on? Why does this thing keep happening? So that's a point of separation or disconnection or suffering. And it throws up some big existential questions, you know, questions about our lives, questions about existence. And, you know, I always say to treasure those questions. We can sometimes think when we have those questions, there's something wrong, you know, with us or our lives. But actually, those questions are pointing us to something deeper, potentially. So that's the beginning of this. That's the kind of beginning. They're the united, and then you have the separation. And then you have that initial reconnection where the father sees the son again. And the father completely recognizes that it is his son. And he's overjoyed. But the son has long forgotten. He's completely forgotten his language. He's forgotten his identity. He's forgotten what his beginnings were, this learning, this growth, his possibilities. It's all far in the recess of his mind. So what does that say about us? Well, from a Buddhist point of view, what Buddhism says is that we have our sort of conscious mind, our known reality. We have the sense of our identity, but so much of our identity is conditioned. So much of who we are is by, you know, through our schooling, through our circumstances, through events that happen to us, and through also the kind of drivers, some of our drivers around craving and greed and hatred. So we have these experiences. But what Buddhism says is that that's not really who we are. Who we are is, you know, loving and wise and pure and intrinsically good. That's what Buddhism says, that we're intrinsically wise and loving beings. But it's all covered over by layers and layers of conditioning. By all the different experiences we might have had and the meanings and interpretations we've made of them. So what part of what we're doing when we practice, part of what we're doing is meditate, when we meditate, is just seeing that more clearly and then being like, actually, who, you know, is that really who I am? Maybe there's more to me than I realise. Somebody said that to me once. I was telling them all some problem I was going through and unpacking all the detail of it, and they just stopped me and said, there's so much more to you than you realise. Do you know that? And I was like, no. For some reason, I don't think I realised it properly at that time. But it stuck with me. And I always kept saying to myself, there's more to me than I know. There's more to me than I realise. There's more to life than I recognise. So Buddhism says that there's more to our experience. We're not just the conditions that we're born in. We identify with those conditions. We identify with the circumstances of our lives. But there's more to us. And part of the path of growth is waking up to that. So the son has forgotten who he truly is, but the father knows who he is. And the father really wants him to see that for himself. But what we have there is this, you know, when he sends people out to get him, he's terrified. He absolutely is scared and just thinks, oh no, that's not what I want. So, yeah, most people, if you said, do you want to grow, do you want to develop? Most people say, yeah, we do want to. And then you say, well, meditate, you know, meditate for a month in the challenge, go on retreat, do this, you know, live ethically, you know, all the things that we say. And on some level, we think, yeah, that makes sense. But another part of us goes, yeah, but not yet. Not yet, not now, not sure. You know, and actually, part of us can be quite... fearful of the unfamiliar, quite fearful of the path of growth. Because with the path of growth, we're tapping into what we don't yet know about ourselves, yeah? We're tapping into the unknown. We're going on a journey which we can't predict how it's going to be. We don't know who we're going to be. We know who we are, so part of us wants to cling to that sense of who we are and then gets a bit scared of the journey ahead. I remember coming into this room, and it was like a mansion when I first came here. I was like, wow, this place is huge. And I could feel the positive energy of this place. But I also was scared of the Buddha. And I remember thinking, I like it here, but I'm not going to look at the Buddha. It's all a bit too much. So we can, even though we want growth, we want development, we can also go, no, not quite yet. I remember when they also talked about enlightenment. Possibility of enlightenment. I thought, yeah, I want to be free from suffering. Absolutely, I want to be from suffering. And then they said, well, that means you're going to uproot, you know, greed, uproot hatred, no more hatred, no more ignorance. And I thought, yeah, I don't want to be ignorant. No more hatred. I thought, no, I don't want hatred, although I do quite like my pet dislikes, you know. And I don't want to like everybody necessarily. I remember thinking that, do I have to like everybody then? And then also when they said craving, I thought, what would that actually be like to not have craving? I thought, I quite like getting excited about things. I quite like wanting things. I quite like having things. Suddenly, the idea of enlightenment wasn't that attractive. So, and I'm just curious, how many of you here, like, yes, I absolutely want to be enlightened? We've got one person over there, very good. And that's just because it's unknown. We don't really know what it is. And we can sort of think, yeah, it sounds nice, but. So that's the son. That's the son when, you know, he's being pursued. And even when he goes to the mansion, that's a bit too much. He's used to, he wants to grow, though. He knows he's suffering. He doesn't want to keep living the life that he's living. Life is hard, yeah? And he's forgotten what the meaning of it is. Is it just surviving? So he does want change, which is why he goes off to this mansion. He's promised something much better than his current experience. And he likes the fact there's a mansion there. He's curious about it, but he's not yet ready to go in. But he's happy with the pile of dirt. He's happy shoveling this dirt. So what does that mean? I'll talk a bit more about the pile of dirt next week, actually. But, in a way, the pile of dirt represents the familiar, represents our conditioning, represents our negative habits, represents the obscurations, the things that cover over our pristine mind, our expansive heart. That's what it represents. And you have to engage in it. Yeah. There's no skipping straight away to the mansion. There's no going, oh yeah, that's I don't want to deal with that. I just want that. Actually, it's what we know. We're working with what we know. And it sounds pejorative, doesn't it? A pile of dirt. But actually, if you think about dirt, soil, there's a lot of nourishment in there, isn't there? There's a lot of growth in the earth. So it's not pejorative necessarily. There's a lot of growth and we have to engage in it. And the more we engage in it, the more we understand its nature. And we also, the more we look towards the mansion. What else is there? So that's what that signifies. So what the father does, he basically creates a plan and says, you know what, it's too much to go straight to him to recognize who he is straight away. He needs a gradual path. He needs a step-by-step approach, which is what we need as well, yeah? We need to kind of just like get to used to our minds and hearts through meditation. I can say, gosh, our mind's pristine, our minds are clear and expansive and our heart's big and open and wide, but you have to experience that for yourself. And it comes through moments, there's glimpses, and the moments might happen on the meditation cushion, but it could equally happen when you're on your way home. It could equally happen the next day when you suddenly see a bird in the sky and you look at the bird and it's as if you're seeing a bird for the very first time and you can go, wow, there is more. There is more to me, to the experience of life than I realise. So in a way, the step, we have to kind of approach it gradually, get to know ourselves gradually. And the more we do that, the more confidence we build up, the more we can work with our fears, the more we realise, actually, yes, I can do this. I can grow. This is for me. Because sometimes also we have a view, and I certainly had this, that, you know, the kind of good life, as it were, the kind of great spiritual life and a life of freedom was for other people. And somehow, you know, I just had to kind of struggle away and hope for the best. And I had to realize over time, no, it's for you too. That is who I am too. And we see that step by step for ourselves. So in a sense, and the mansion, what does the mansion represent? Well, the mansion is our potential. The mansion is this big, expansive self, a big perspective, abundance, you know, seeing its abundance, its joy, its beauty, its spaciousness. That's what the mansion represents. And who is the father? Who is the great man? The great man is who we, is the great being is who we can grow into. We all have this great being within us. And we kind of have that sense of it from time to time. You know, when we see, I don't know, like a really great movie, or we hear great music, or see something that really uplifts us, that's uplifting our sense of what's possible for ourselves as well. So it's unfamiliar, and yet some level it's deeply familiar. So life can just carry on like that. The son, as we heard in the story, he gets used to being in the mansion. He enjoys it. He thinks, wow, I'm so fortunate. He begins to help other people to discover themselves more and more. And the story could absolutely end there. But of course, the great man, he's still a human being. Time passes, aging happens. And towards the end of the story, well, of course, you can imagine that he's now getting old. Still got a great spirit, still got a great humour, energy on some level, but he's physically getting old. And the time comes when he is on his deathbed. Time has passed. His time's coming to an end. And he has this scene where different people are coming to say, pay their respects. And he gives them all these last words of advice or counsel or just appreciation. And the young man, he's kind of a great man himself now. And, people look to him for guidance. And the father asks to see him last. So he's by himself. And, the father basically, really rejoices in him. Says, tells him how amazing he's been, how much he's appreciated him. And at that point, there is finally a recognition. The father just looks at him and says, do you know who I am? Do you know who you really are? And there's something in that where the son finally sees that that is his father, and it always was his father. And the father says, we were always together. I was never apart from you. We're together now, and I will always be with you. And so, and you are now the heir. Continue this great work. And with that, he closes his eyes and he passes away. So what's the end mean for us? Well, this is what happens on the journey of growth. On the journey of growth, you're encountering all kinds of unfamiliar aspects of yourself. You're seeing life a bit more clearer. Things are coming out of the unconscious into the conscious. Life's getting bigger. And sometimes, you're encountering the challenges. You're still having to occasionally go back to the soil, go back to the earth, do some more digging. But every now and again, the more you do that, the more the bigger the mansion becomes, the bigger the palace is, the more perspective there is. But in that, you're becoming more and more like yourself. You're becoming more and more who you truly are, which is this paradox. Like, you've had to go on this long journey. You've had to do all these activities to become more and more who you truly are. You're reconnecting with, your purpose. You're reconnecting with the kind of what it really means to be human. You're reconnecting with the essential nature of life. You're becoming whole. You're no longer separated off from yourself. You're becoming whole, and you're not just reunited with all the different aspects of yourself. You're reunited with, you become your potential. You've realized your potential. You become the great man, if you like. You become the great being. But you're also deeply connected to the very fabric of life itself. You feel deeply interwoven, interconnected, not separate from the very nature of life itself. And that is the sort of ultimate return journey. You've returned to the freedom that you deeply aspired, that you saw as possible from the very beginnings of life. And that's the end. or the return journey. Thank you. So thank you very much. So next week I'll be talking about symbols, the power of symbol, and I'll be bringing a symbol. I'll be going back to the heap of soil or dirt, and I'll be bringing a symbol to share with you that is a really powerful symbol for me at the moment, and in Buddhism as well. I don't know if there's any, should we end there? Some questions? What time do we end? Is it right now?
Got
time. Okay, so if there's any burning questions, we'll take a question or two. Maybe that's.
Oh, I've got a question.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Right.
I'm going to say.
So it's called the method of return journey. And is that to say that a return journey is a myth, or it is a myth about return?
The myth is the archetypal truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a truth that transcends. This is how I'm using the myth in a sense. A truth that transcends, you know, the individual details of life, and that it relates to all of life. Yeah. So that's the myth. And the return journey is returning to who we truly are. Yeah, thank you.
Do you experience hatred?
Do I experience hatred? That's a great question. Easily answered. I don't experience hatred in the way I used to. Yeah. In fact, I used to sort of like feel like I had a, you know, like I'd have this anger, you know, that would arise, and I'd be like, yeah, I'm justified in that. And I sort of like, you know, enjoy it on a certain level. I don't enjoy if I have any negativity now, it's not an enjoyable thing. It's something that I immediately almost want to kind of let go of. But the journey, there's still a journey to that sometimes. Yeah. So I understand now, which I don't think I did before, the kind of pain of it. And somebody said to me once, hatred is like, well, not somebody, I think it's a metaphor that the Buddha had. He said it's like picking up a burning coal and throwing it at somebody. And I would often be aware of, in the past, I'd be like aware of the coal and the throwing it, but I wouldn't really be fully aware of how I was suffering from that. So now I'm like, drop it. Yeah. Thank you. Should we end it there? Thank you very much, yeah.